Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon, right at the cusp. My name is Patrick Martins. You're listening to The Main Course. We're produced and engineered by Joe Galarraga. Hey, Joe, are you there today?
Yeah, I'm here. How's it going, Patrick?
How's it going?
Doing well.
Very, very good. We're sponsored by Hearst Ranch, one of the most inspiring food companies in the country. And wow, it's been a really busy week. How's it been going for you with all the shows, Joe?
It's been good. It's been lots of really interesting guests coming through this week. So it's, I always say that this is like the best job because I just learned so much just sitting here and listening to people talk. So
you owe me. No, you owe Jack, Aaron. This is going to be a great show. We're going to do a real interesting kind of study in what it is to open a restaurant, an almost predictor of sorts for anyone out there who's listening who one day will open a restaurant. We predict that this show is going to help them, you know, predict what that experience is going to be like. And we're going to talk to Corey Kova, who is in studio with us. Hey, Corey.
How you doing?
Well, for people who don't know, Corey, do you wear hats when you're at the restaurant? Because you have these flowing Michael Landon House on the Prairie locks.
Gotta keep up.
You have all this hair.
Like to keep a good headband. hairnets.
Yeah.
Cowboy hats.
Wow, you have Michael Landon hair. That's
thanks, man.
Really awesome. So, Joe, you're going to play in a second Jack's Bonnaroo moment,
yes.
Right? I mean, he went out to Bonnaroo and covered it, and
yes.
It's a really great 8-minute piece, so we're going to get to that. But tell us, what were some of the favorite shows? Did you have a favorite that had to do with ketchup, maybe?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was pretty specific. But yes, actually, before the show, we were talking about how a lot of restaurants will, you know, try to do this house-made ketchup kind of thing. But people, you know, people don't really want that. People, the thing with ketchup is that people want something they know. They want something that they can dip their fries in, and it's going to, like, stick to their French fries. But so there were, we had Mark and Scott in from Sir Kensington's Gourmet Scooping Ketchup. That's the name of the brand.
Wow.
And
but it's still not Heinz.
It's not Heinz. The market that they're going for is they want to create, you know, you have like a Dijon mustard, you have like the stone ground mustard. They want to create an alternative ketchup.
Don't do it. That's my advice to them. Do not do it. People are so arrogant. I mean, I think Heinz 57 is a tribute to American gastronomy. And it's so what people are used to. And the other ones so often go off the side of tomato saucy. It's a great sauce. It's just not ketchup. Anyway, Corey, what do you feel about this? Because you've gone to both sides.
No, yeah. I think people putting, especially in restaurants in the city, people putting ketchup that's house made is entirely ego.
Huh.
At least for us. It was kind of a big deal. It was a big production, and we had like 5 different people helping out on it. But it was weird, and it was too, you know, you get some that are too sweet or too salty or like have horseradish or whatever. We eventually backed off and we're 100% Heinz now. Just because that's what people expect. I think there's maybe one or two people a night will probably appreciate it, but everyone else just kind of gets annoyed.
No, yeah, well, Anne's one who appreciates those things. Anyway, no offense to you, Corey, but in my this book I'm writing, one of the short chapters is, please don't make your own ketchup, you arrogant bastard. No, but it's just funny that I'm always... I mean, the only thing that offends me is if a restaurant doesn't also have Heinz. I mean, it's
right,
great
yeah.
to do both. I mean, that I actually encourage. Because, again, the other one might serve a purpose that's not for competing with ketchup. Dipping calamari or something like that. Anyway, I'm going off too long about this, but let's roll the Bonnaroo tapes.
All right,
and then we're going to talk about a day in the life of Corey Kova, the chef of ABV Kitchen and Wine Bar.
Heritage Radio Network at
Heritage Radio Network was at Bonnaroo 2012 to get a sense of how food plays into the 4-day multi-stage camping festival held on a 700-acre farm in Manchester, Tennessee. In its 11th year, Bonnaroo has become the preeminent music and arts festival in the U.S. Known for its communal artistic atmosphere and legendary all-night performances, this machine has been finely tuned into a cultural staple. The event is put on by Superfly Presents, an entertainment agency founded by four college friends from New Orleans. Self-described foodies, the guys at Superfly Presents are also behind the Great Googa Mooga, the food-themed festival in Prospect Park, which celebrated its first year in May 2012. It's clear that food is becoming a bigger focus for Superfly Presents, and that was apparent at this year's Bonnaroo. Throwing Bonnaroo is an enormous undertaking and somewhat of a logistical nightmare. This is especially true for food vendors feeding festival attendees. According to Cindy Dupree from the Tennessee Department of Tourism, more than 80,000 people spend the weekend at the festival grounds, making it temporarily the sixth largest city in Tennessee. This year's festival featured headlining performances from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Phish, and Radiohead. It also included a rare performance from legendary R&B singer D'Angelo, who took the stage in the U.S. for the first time in 12 years on Sunday morning at about 1 a.m.
I've been waiting 12 years to sing this. Ladies and gentlemen, D'Angelo.
We caught up with Dapwell of Das Racis, who performed on Saturday, to ask him what he ate on the way down to Tennessee and at the festival.
Hey, I'm Dap from Das Racis here at Bonnaroo 2012. We got here yesterday morning. We were in Kimball, Tennessee at a Comfort Inn. So I walked through the strip mall to China Buffet in Kimball off I-24, and it was very good for what it was. And they had very good service and a very good mint mousse dessert that was very unexpected. And then we were in Bonnaroo, and then I ate in the artist's area hospitality food tent. Today I ate sea bass. I had sea bass with chimichurri for the first time. Oh yeah, they had rice. I'm South Indian. I have to eat rice constantly. White rice, giant amounts of quality. Like basmati, not like gross Carolina rice. And they had a giant amount of basmati rice, and I ate probably like a pound of it. Now I feel insane.
Drummer Adam Criscow of the Vermont-based rock band Dispatch shared his food experiences on tour.
I've been vegetarian my whole life. So being a touring musician on the road, it's always really hard to find really great vegetarian food. In the back, they had some veggie burgers and lots of great salad fixings and stuff like that. You never know what you're going to get at a festival. It always varies.
Sierra Leonean singer Giancanabe, who leads the Boo Boo Gang band from New York, describes his second life as the driver of an Ethiopian food truck.
Right now, my second job is food. I work with four Joel brothers in D.C., the first food truck in D.C. The truck that I drive right now is 106 years old, and we sell Ethiopian food, Thailand food, and Indian food. Jara is from Ethiopia. You can't get it nowhere in America. So, I mean, like, any morning, the 8 o'clock flight from Ethiopia...
It flies in.
Flies in with the Jara, and then they keep it warm, they bring it, and then we use it.
While good music is always to be expected at Bonnaroo, this year's event featured the second annual Food Truck Oasis, a section of the festival devoted to local and national mobile kitchens serving sustainable and delicious grub. Here's a sampling of what some of the trucks had to offer.
We're Gastropod, Mobile Gourmet from Miami, MIA, where the Heat play. We're just serving up the masses, keeping it simple at Bonnaroo. We're just doing a few of our Gastropod menu classics. We've got our Sloppy Jose. It's Jose because there's more Jose's than Joe in Miami. It's just pulled pork on a Martin's potato roll that we toast, and we serve it with our stupid slaw and our Q sauce, which is just a take on like a southern barbecue. Pork is just Duroc. We actually braise them in a pressure cooker for 55 minutes, and it just breaks down all the fat and renders it super tender. We're going through like 200 pounds a day of pork. Oh. So yeah, we can't really braise it for 6 hours.
Wow.
Or smoke it.
So we are at the Gypsy Queen
cuisine food truck at Bonnaroo. And your name again is?
My name is Susie Phillips.
Awesome.
We are serving Lebanese food. For Bonnaroo, we're not doing any meat. It's strictly vegan, vegetarian. But here we're doing falafel Lebanese style, fried cauliflower, tabbouleh. We're doing quinoa tabbouleh, so it's gluten-free. And hummus.
Surprisingly, sustainability and local sourcing seem to be a common thread that tied these vendors together. But while Bonnaroo may have been an accommodating space for the food trucks, Susie Phillips of Gypsy Queen Cuisine explained how she had to fight for her right to serve food in the streets of Asheville, North Carolina, while shouting out some of her other favorite chefs and restaurants in the area.
I fought the city in the past 2 years because food trucks weren't allowed. And I won September 13th. We passed a new ordinance. So now we're downtown.
So you did that?
Yeah.
Whoa, that's crazy. And so you do serve meat at the food truck in Asheville?
Yeah, we serve lamb from East Fork Farms in Asheville. And then when it's not available, we go to Mountain Memory, which is in Virginia. And then the chicken is from Farside Farms, which is in Asheville.
One last question. If people were going to Asheville, who are some of the chefs you're excited about, some of the restaurants you like out there?
Oh, Jacob Sessoms from Table. He's awesome. Brian Canapelli from Cucina 24 is great. We're all, you know, like-minded. We think local and do amazing things for the people in the community.
Roti rolls from Charleston, South Carolina served delicious kimchi and curried foods wrapped in Indian flatbreads. Eatbox, also from Asheville, North Carolina, featured gourmet meatballs, and owner Molly Clark had some suggestive yet wise words for the public.
We're raising money for Planned Parenthood this weekend, so we're just encouraging all men to eat box before they wrap their meat.
The food truck oasis wasn't the only place for delicious artisanal food. Bushwick, Brooklyn's critically acclaimed Roberta's Pizza, the very place that Heritage Radio Network broadcasts from, had a mobile pizza unit on the premises. The Roberta staff were a busy bunch. Not only were they feeding festival goers, they catered the artist VIP area and backstage parties for Radiohead, The Roots, The Chili Peppers, and more. We caught pizza guru Anthony Falco for a minute, who had his hands full.
We're equipped to do like 2,000 pizzas a day. We were open today at 10. We're going until 2 a.m.
Wow. How close is that end line?
It's fun. We're just trying to, like, go 24 hours. Do you have any Adderall?
Roberta's co-owner, Brandon Hoy, was moving a mile a minute, but found some time to enjoy himself as well.
The best thing that happened to me at Bonnaroo was there was this one chick that I had to walk behind for a while that had, like, the greatest ass ever, and I got to walk behind her for, like, 10 minutes. That was probably the best time that I had since I've been here.
Food options at large events and festivals have always been less than ideal, and it's good to see the guys behind Bonnaroo trying to turn that habit around. While there is still an overwhelming amount of standard, greasy, frozen-then-fried festival snacks, there were plenty of other healthy options to be had. Hopefully next year, things will shift even further towards the sustainable side of food. This piece was produced by Jack Inslee, Jesse Kiefer, and Jason Colucci for HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Calling moan to see the son Lewis leave his home. Angel laid him away. Angel laid him away. They laid him 6 feet under the clay. Angel laid him away. Kind friends, oh, ain't it hard to see poor Louis in a new graveyard. Angel laid him away. Bob shot once and Louis shot two. They shot poor Colin, shot him through.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
God, I love both those songs. What was that first song, Joe?
That was an old 78 of Mississippi John Hurt. It was called Louis Collins.
And the second one was Brian Kenny from the Hearst Ranch. Anyway, very, very good. I love that clip from Jack. I mean, what a great recording. First of all, there's that place that goes through 200 pounds of pork a day down in Florida.
That's ridiculous.
And then that woman, she said, eat box before they wrap their meat. I mean, that was a great line. So anyway, we're in studio with Corey Kova, the chef of ABV Kitchen and Wine Bar. You also used to work at Earl's Beer and Cheese, which is the same owner. And where we first maybe worked together was when you were with Momofuku Sambar back in the day. So welcome to the studio.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So today we're going to talk about, now you just opened a restaurant, ABV. So
right.
We really wanted to see, you know, to predict for future restaurateurs what their experience would be like. So we were going to basically pick your brain. So
okay.
When did the, tell us about Earl's Beer and Cheese first of all, and then when you first heard about this new space on the Upper East Side.
Okay. So yeah, I was working at some, this was a few years back, you know, really wanted to get out of the scene from downtown, exploring different neighborhoods. And I came up and saw the place. So it has a big mural up on the side of a kind of a forest scene. There's like a few deer, and it's tiny. It's like 24 seats.
This is Earl's,
yeah. And the owners were completely in... They looked mad. One of them had just gone running in the park, but was wearing street clothes. So I didn't know what to think. Anyway,
what was this mural of, by the way? Which forest? Like North American forest?
I have bears? No. There was ducks.
Ducks.
Deers.
Deers, okay.
Some trees.
Okay.
No, it was cool. It was more just the opportunity to go out and do something on my own. And also the neighborhood, there was nothing else up there. But I don't know if you've seen the logo for this, but it's pretty much a pig wearing a top hat with antlers coming out.
So an Upper East Side pig.
An Upper East Side pig. And that's all I saw. And they pretty much, wanted a cheese-themed menu. And I thought it was too much fun to pass up. So, you know, signed on for that. It was, like, dead for the first few months.
I mean, just to contextualize this for our listeners, New York City's Upper East Side is, like, Upper West Side, for instance, is famous. Lincoln Center's there.
Right.
Ballerinas, actors used to live there. Now it still has a big Hispanic community on the Upper West Side. Then contrast that with the Upper East Side, just on the other side of Central Park, and you have, I guess, a lot of old money.
Yeah, you do. We're at 97th,
right?
So anything below, anything below is old money, stuff like that.
Explain that cusp between 96th and 97th for our listeners.
Well, anything above 96th Street is technically East Harlem. But, you know, we get labeled Upper East Side all the time. The Post is running next week some story on downtown moving up, and they included us in the Upper East Side, collective. But
and yet, nonetheless, it's a barren food landscape.
It
despite
is.
Despite the wealth and supposed education.
Yeah, it is so bizarre.
Yeah.
There's, Kitchen Arts and Letters, which is, you know.
Knack Waxman's place?
Yeah, that's, everyone knows that, and... Still, there's like more fine, like Italian, more expensive options.
Well, the Second Avenue Deli lives up there. Antonucci, the great chef Francesco Antonucci, he has Antonucci's. I mean, his menu has like 90 things. He used to be the owner of Remy, which was a massive block long restaurant. Now he's contained in this little restaurant, but he still hasn't cut any of the dishes there. And then I'm trying to think. I mean, there's some historic old Greek coffee shops, the one right by the Metropolitan Museum, where people from that neighborhood still go and get the cheeseburger. But it's really few and far between the well-known restaurants up there. So was that a challenge when...
No, it wasn't at all, just because it was... Primarily, it's supposed to be a dive bar. The owners weren't really interested in having a... they just wanted cheese sandwiches. Before they opened, they... imagine one of the two of them, just anytime someone got hungry, going back to the kitchen and like throwing together a sandwich. So, I mean, it was thought out. It just wasn't realistic to the environment that, you know, ended up coming through. So it was, I mean, it was actually a ton of fun. They gave me as much freedom as I wanted. So it was more of just focusing on the people living directly above and trying to make sure when they come in and they order something that, you know, it's something they would want to eat while they're drinking beer. And it worked out.
And it worked out. So then let's talk about, when did you first hear about the space at ABV?
I mean, it was probably, I guess it was August.
Which year?
August of last year. So August 2011. I was about to leave. I wasn't close to leave, but I felt we pretty much took Earl's as far as we could take it. The menu was pretty complex at that point. And Michael, one of the owners, he originally moved to the
What do you mean by complex?
We had at one point two desserts, pickling Green Market vegetables for like a whole big platter, a couple different like entree type dishes that we'd been working on. Probably the one of the better, I mean, definitely the best farmstead cheese selection within 20 blocks at least. And then the core menu.
How did you hook that up? What business did you have to hook that great thing up?
You know, before we opened, I went down to Essex Street Market, and I went to Saxby Cheesemongers.
Okay, yeah. Heard of it?
Yeah. There was like an intern working there, and she said she had been working. I told her I was going to go, you know, there and stop by Murray's, and she said that the level of customer service would be better. It's much more personal. You know, down with Saxley, down with Ann.
Well, in any public market it is. I just love the idea of like 30 vendors all going in on a space together.
No, it's a madhouse and it's awesome.
Yeah. Do you use any of those Central American vegetables and fruits that they are hard to find but that exist down there?
No, I mean, I'll go pick up some random things just to kind of play around with, but it's not practically to get enough of that stuff. I usually stop down. I go by Ann's with bags full of Green Market vegetables most of the time, so I don't have like the extra hand to take it all away.
I love it. You carry all that stuff. So I'm sorry, we got off on a tangent. So you had taken Earl's beer and cheese menu to a sophisticated place. So, you know, you were already had done something great there, and then this opportunity comes up.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I hadn't known, I think it was February or March of the same year, one of the owners of Earl's, along with a couple of friends of his, had signed lease for this corner space on 97th and Lexington, which had been empty for a couple of years. I think it was a deli before that.
It's amazing that there's an empty space for 2 years.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. And it is really
that threshold between 96 and 97, the city. It's also where the train comes above ground.
Right, yeah, right on Park. I mean, I think there's a Starbucks on 96 and Lex, and after that went in, I think a couple, you know, light bulbs went off. They signed the space. They had a friend. So ABV, the owners, had a friend that was a pretty prominent chef who was going to, you know, do the food. I was just going to go pretty much work for him at ABV. But
You killed him?
I murdered him, and I buried his body in a dog park in Washington Heights.
All right.
No, that didn't work out. So, they asked me if I'd like to be a part of it and, you know, have control of all that. So I said, yeah.
So define that control. I mean, does that mean that they would give you their basic ideas and then you would go ahead and make your vision for what the...
Yeah, I mean, it started out as a wine pub, was a name for it. I'd never heard anything like that. they eventually just went with wine bar, and, you know, we just refer to it as the bar now. And it was just food that is supposed to go well with this awesome wine list that she had put together.
It's interesting that both places started first with the drink in mind and then food that would go well with it.
No, if people were expecting good food when they went into either place, I think they would be they wouldn't be let down, but they don't know. I just feel like people go in for the drinks, and it's just good to have like solid food behind it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the menu is... I mean, we'll talk about the menu in a second, but I really want to try to stay focused. It's so interesting, all these things about thinking about how it really happens from a chronological level.
Right.
So you go down and see this space. Did you see in that space... How big is it? Just to...
Wow. Square footage, I'm not really sure. It's about 60 people. It has an open kitchen and a full bar that sits about, 12 to 15.
So you went in there and you were like, "This is big enough for me. I can do this."
It was like four times the size of Earl's. Just this big, and there's a basement, which was awesome. So we went in. I said okay, and then I took a few months just to basically help them build it out. I was out on the sidewalk with a pipe threader, making with all these plumbing equipment. We made all the light fixtures inside, installed. Install the fryer, the walk-in, everything that's downstairs.
Were you, as the chef, making the argument for more kitchen space and less bar space? Or, I mean, how did that...
Not at all. The layout was pretty much... The layout and the large equipment, like the... we have a CVAT, which costs, thousands of dollars. I don't know how much.
What's that?
It's pretty much a steam oven, like a very sophisticated thing. And they... Before I had been brought on, they went to someone who advised them on what equipment to get. So they pretty much had all the big equipment.
What's the advantage of that very expensive CVAT machine?
It's a very powerful steamer, so you could braise, you could bake, you could... It's very versatile.
So what does that mean? You can do it faster than you would if you didn't have that tool, or better?
You could do it faster. I think... You really can't do anything better. It's just more efficient. There's a lot of cool things you can do with it. We're still trying to figure it out.
So what does that mean in terms of a menu? When a kitchen has that piece as a big primary piece, what is going to come out to the final consumer?
I wish we had something. We really don't use it at all right
now.
Oh,
really?
And it's our biggest, most expensive.
What, because it's the summer?
Not because it's the summer, it's because we have a big convection oven. I'm just more familiar with, more comfortable using. We steam a good amount of things, but I really can't say it has any impact on the menu.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know if braising cut means you use more shanks and shoulders and kind of heavier, molasses-y or...
Well, the thing a lot of people don't realize about ABV and Earl's is the kitchens are both electric. So most... Any food that's not braised or slow roasted is going to be pretty small.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you see this space, you help them build it out, and when does your job as chef start to kick in, when you're not going above and beyond to...
It started with the first meetings of what direction we wanted to take it, what the we wanted to come up with, not really a brand, but more of a concept behind it, and which is something we're still working out. We're still trying to find what would fit there, what kind of food would we continue to do. And as we got closer, we came up with drafts of the menu. We came up with how many people we think would have to work there, where we would get cleaning supplies, where we get all our food from.
Well, just expand on that menu bit again. So what did you conceive for it?
The original inside, I thought it was going to be me and one other person. Like, I didn't know how big the food program there was going to be. I thought it was going to be quite small. So I think there was maybe, two desserts and six or seven menu items. And then we went through, it's just a lot of back and forth. It's a lot of, cause I don't own it. So I pretty much have to mold what I would want to see in there, to the expectations of the owners.
Mm-hmm. So, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of fun. If I, if I had put what I thought would go well on there, it would be I think pretty bizarre, because the neighborhood is big, and with something that size up there, we kind of need to make a lot of people happy, like a lot of different options. If it was a 30 seat restaurant, we could take it to one extreme or the other, but we kind of have to find a middle ground and not really compromise, but kind of you know, really put thought into who's coming in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's always that compromise, happy compromise of the two chefs' tables a week.
Yeah.
You know, you fill up an eight top, and those people could always just get the... They pay a lot more, but they get something totally creative and unique that's never been done before.
Right.
But so you did that, and do they know all the details of how many people you need and the dishwashers and all that? I mean, do they know that already, or do they look to you to answer those questions?
No, I mean, everyone had a bit of experience in restaurants, so I wasn't entirely on my own, but I did have to like kind of ballpark some numbers as far as cooks, dishwashers. So what we went for when we opened, it was just to overstaff, which worked out pretty well.
Some people just leave, and
yeah, some people leave, some people just it's not really the right, not that it's the right job, but it's not, maybe not the right career. We've had people who were, or we had one guy who was an accountant for 10 years who came in and just like really couldn't deal with the environment. We had another, we had one guy that came in, we paid him for like 2 weeks, and then he just stopped showing up, never even came in for his last paycheck.
Sounds like crack cocaine, maybe? What drugs have that? Joe, what drugs is that a phenomenon with, not showing up to work and not even picking up money that's deserved to you? What drugs do that?
Oh, I would say it would have to be some sort of downer, probably, right?
So, who else?
Bath salts.
People trickle out. Yeah, and then stayed? Who was the real... I mean, who's your right-hand person? Who can you trust that place to if you had to leave?
Well, we had one guy who came in, and he just looked like his whole life he had just, you know, gotten beat down pretty rough. Was used to the environment, putting out a lot of food. And it wasn't like I saw him and I knew, you know, it was going to work out. He could have left easily too, but he ended up, now he's pretty much the sous chef. So he's, people who like don't have unrealistic expectations of what the job's going to have.
Like where they're cooking for the Obamas.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Kind of thing. And doing their own stuff where they're just coming in and doing the thing and keeping it consistent.
Right.
That's great. It's a lost art. You know, that's what the whole conception of apprentice, and then you would become a journeyman and work for another master, and then eventually you too would become a master, and apprentices would come to you.
Right.
It's a real lost art form, you know?
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, we've had, I think, just one guy. Yeah, one guy started out as a dishwasher, and he was so... it's just his work ethic. We eventually made him a cook, and he... You
industriousness.
Know, a bright kid. Yeah.
What do you look for in guys? Like, when you're looking for that staff, is it just busyness or smartness in the crunch?
Yeah, it's a mixture of a lot of things. Not... Maybe, like, common sense, determination, kind of perseverance. They don't mind if I get a little grabby. That's always big. Good sense of humor. I don't know. That's pretty much it. As long as they, you know, as long as they show up to work every day and try to do a little bit better. It's amazing the amount of people who just, like, stop trying or just come in and you know, treat it as a job that they really don't care if they could be there or not. So.
So then the staffing. So when do you first start? Tools are in. Any other big equipment? You have a big convection oven, a big...
We actually started with a tiny, tiny convection oven. So that lasted like 2 weeks before we realized we needed another one. Just because the steam oven, the CVAP we got, every time you open it, all the steam comes out. So it's not something we could, you know, open 50, 100 times a night and have it maintain its heat.
Well, let's visualize this. So give us the stage now. So you get there, all the equipment's in, and you have to put all your stuff, your knives, your water, you know, that you drink when you're busy. I mean, you have to set the whole stage. So tell us about how the stage is set and how you kind of set it up into its kind of like old catcher's mitt style where it's like perfect.
Right. Well, it was pretty much, I mean, there was dirt on the ground. There was, you know, no walls were finished. The bar finally went up, and it's just like, you know, 2x4s and a ceramic bar went on top, at one point. But I think it was like, we opened at the end of January, and I'd say in you know, just after Thanksgiving, we had the final space where you could walk in and you could see where everything was going to be. You could see where the banquets were going to be. You could see the the bar was starting to get set up. So from there, we just it's a matter of cleaning and putting the final touches on a lot of cosmetic things. Like we have this glass barrier between where people sit and where the kitchen is upstairs. It's a big open kitchen. And downstairs, as soon as the walk-in went in, it was a lot of, you know, we had to paint the floor, paint the ceiling, get the ice machine in, get the walk-ins in. And then a lot of the stuff had actually gone in, and it looked like a real restaurant before the electricity had even been turned on. So once that went on, we came in, slowly started to build or buy food, bring food in, get all the small appliances in, because we had bought, you know, we had bought plates and all these things beforehand, you know, blenders, stuff like that. So we slowly started to put it in, and over the next month, we just arranged things around, did a lot of testing, went back over the menu and to see what would be appropriate or what we'd be able to pull off.
And a lot of it is just minimization of motion, right? You want things to be right, perfect to your arm's reach so that you can grab it. I mean, it's got to be efficient on that level as well, right? Where things are placed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of, you really have to have a good imagination, I think, if you're going to open, you know, any kind of restaurant. What we ended up doing, there were a few restaurants that had gone out of business, and they would, you know, call up a friend of one of the owners, and we'd go down and kind of just pillage and take what we could. So after you do all that, you kind of set up and you try to imagine what's going to be most efficient. What we had imagined before didn't really work out perfectly, but I mean, it's something we're still, you know, we're always going to be working with, I think. But it's a lot of trial and error.
So then it finally opens and you're pulling off those first few dishes. What were your top sellers for the first few months?
Oh, wow.
And is it the same today?
No, not at all. It was so bizarre. Before we opened, we had a very complex menu with like a ton of man hours that would go into prepping out a certain dish. I think when you guys came in for the friends and family, we definitely had pierogies on the menu, and that was me staying until like 1 o'clock the morning before actually folding all of them, filling them with the beef cheek.
Is that something you learned at Sambar? Because I had heard that of David Chang's restaurants, like they put a tremendous attention to prep many hours before.
Oh, yeah.
So that when actually the person orders it, it's just executing it, firing it.
Yeah, that's absolutely where it was from. And that was supposed to be, you know, that's how, I'm convinced that's how it's supposed to be. With ABV, it's not really the case, just because it's so large and there's so many, we have such young cooks who are trying to do just the we're trying to get them with good fundamentals and just do the basics right now. But yeah, when we opened, we had our foie gras dish was a funnel cake. Our tartar pizza was awful. Like, we still have it on. It took us probably a month of trial and error to get it to where it's to where we wanted. Like, it's pretty.
Would people get violently ill and stuff?
No, no. It tasted good, but compared to where it is now, it wasn't even on the same level.
You're like, how could I have served that piece of shit? How could I have done it?
At the time, though, you think like, oh, that's good. But once you finally figure it out and like everything comes together, it's just like so much better.
How much percentage wise? It's a stupid question, but from 1 to 10, how much has the restaurant changed and how much has it stayed the same? I mean, from 1 to 100, I mean, has it changed 90% or has it changed like 10?
I would say, I mean,
should people prepare for if they're going to open a restaurant? Okay. Do you stick to your guns, or what should you allow yourself in terms of being like, that was a stupid idea? Or it just is not tasting great.
I mean, if I had to make a prediction for anyone else in that position, the cocktail, the wine program have not changed at all from what I can see. But there's going to be some things where you're going to, you know, get frustrated and ask yourself, you know, how could that happen? But it's only maybe like 20 to 30% different from where we started. It's very fine tuning, so it's hard to really gauge it. It's down, you know, every day a little change is coming in, but it's at the end of the day, you know, you're just working to get it to where you want it. When we opened, yeah, it was a little jarring because it was a big setback because things weren't where we wanted it. But now, you know, that's the fun of going in every day and trying to make it more and more like you wanted it. So, you know, maybe it started with a larger change than we thought, but now it's like much closer to the original vision for everyone, I think.
Very interesting. And what are the top sellers today? I mean, tell us about the whole menu today. If someone of our listeners is going to go to 97th, okay, cross the threshold.
Well, you could, we have a few bar snacks, which would be like, you know, fried pickles, which are, you know, for $5, you get a ton of fried pickles, and that's more just a bar snack. I have seen the most petite girls come in and order that as like, dinner, and it's so bizarre to watch them eat a ton of fried pickles.
Wow.
That's pretty good. Summer's coming up. We just put a shaved zucchini salad on with, you know, fennel, dill, grapefruit, which is pretty killer. It's not anywhere close to what we've had before because it's much more lighter. We just put fish tacos on. I'm from California, and I,
oh yeah,
yeah, so I need
not great tacos out here.
No, it was,
I went to Grand Electrica.
Oh, how was that?
And well, Anne got sick the next day, but she's, oh, pregnant, so that has nothing to do with it. But that was just kind of trying to be funny. No, I thought it was very good, and I don't normally like corn tortillas.
Okay.
I always like flour.
Yeah.
I know that's bad. Like, it's like liking light chocolate and right. Budweiser and you know, American cheese. But nonetheless, I liked it. Something they did was good. But people say, basically, Mexican food is just very bad here on the East Coast in general.
You know, I'm pretty close to 116th up there, and there's a few good places to get a taco.
Okay.
I actually came down, I went to Brooklyn Taco, which they're all like so killer. I think they do a very good job with everything they do except their fish taco.
So what makes yours great? Is it wasabi mayo or
no,
something?
No, no. Theirs was like a kind of like a sauteed mahi-mahi. I mean, it wasn't bad. But yeah, I'm used to like the big Baja style, like fried guys, and we have like a sriracha batter that we you know, dip them all in, kimchi cabbage mixture.
Give us two more dishes.
Two more dishes. Let's see. The Fluffernutter just got a big.
Into desserts. You've mentioned three times desserts first. You've said how many desserts you've done, and then how much the rest of the menu.
Right?
Are you a secret dessert guy?
I am. I love.
I can tell.
It's so much fun. Like, we're working on.
We broke the story. Heritage Radio Network. That's a tweet, Joe. We broke it. He's really secretly a dessert guy.
It's, I already sent it out. Don't worry.
So that's interesting. That was always your interest in the kitchen, or did you come to like that?
No, I mean, that was that's our foie gras dish. So it's not not technically. I mean, it's pretty sweet, but no, I actually did pastry at Pure Food and Wine, which is a vegan restaurant. After working, you know, for Michael Simon and working, you know, I trailed all over the city, worked in probably 15 or 20 kitchens in my four-year period where I was at CIA. So I was coming down every weekend and, like, checking out the different things. And it wasn't...
So from Hyde Park into the city?
Yeah, on the weekends. So it's, you know, hour and a half. Three-hour commute, you know, back and forth. But you get...
Hudson River Line.
Yeah.
The Hudson River Line,
that's right?
To Poughkeepsie, or...?
Yeah, to Poughkeepsie. Yep. So you get down... I mean, if you think of it as an extra class and not where you're going down and working for free in all these places and trying to, like, figure out where you'll fit in... you know, pastry always had, they weren't as hot, mm-hmm. like they weren't like, as flustered all the time. And it was just, I love the thought of just eating all the stuff I just prepped when nobody's looking.
I always compare pastry chefs to goalies in soccer and drummers in bands.
Yeah.
While everyone else is doing their thing, they're often on the side, like, the goalie's doing weird, like, jumping exercises.
Or, like, stretching.
Yeah, the drummer's, like, got a whole office to build, you know, and the pastry people are off with their little beakers and smoke coming out of it. Anyway, well, this has been real interesting. I mean, we could have kept going on.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is just the lens, and you should definitely come back and continue this, because I thought it's fascinating. You really did cover a lot. Tools, workers, relationship with the ownership.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even get into how much fun it is to, you know, go and, as a chef, to go find and build relationships with purveyors.
All the chefs say that.
Yeah.
Although I can't say Corey really does. You buy whole lambs from us, whole goats. You come down to the market and see what's going on.
Oh, yeah. I'm very hands-on. Just ask any of the waitresses at the wine bar.
Oh, hello.
Hey, just kidding.
Da-da-da. Joe! Sound effect, man. God. These kids, are in radio and don't honor the old whistle and foghorn and, like...
That's a bit of the olden days. That's old. That's
all that stuff. It's comic gold.
I want a baby crying in a kazoo every time I talk.
Joe nailed saying it was a downer. It must have been a downer, but he missed. So you leave even Steven, Joe.
Man, I was hoping to get promoted, but whatever.
Promoted from intern to paid intern? Never. Anyway, well, thanks, everybody. We have other shows coming on. Straight No Chaser, then a rerun of the Mike and Judy show. Then we have Jason Colucci's Morning After. Finally, we have Burning Down the House with Curtis B. Wayne. What's the B stand for? No one knows.
Not all right. Clue.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.